right, here we go. So welcome back. To the last session, we did the third step prayer. And and next it says, on bottom of 63, it says, next we launched out in a course of vigorous action. The first step of which was a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. It's using the words like launched and vigorous. Right? I've got another story for you. This one you might not have heard. You heard the one about the crows, right? With the third step. There's three frogs on a lily pad in a pond. One decides to jump off the lily pad and swim away. And it does. And then another one decides to jump off and swim away, and it does. And then the third one decides to jump off and swim away, but it doesn't do anything. It turned yellow and drank. You have to think about that one a little bit. The bottom line is making that decision that you want that power in your life and then not doing anything, stopping at this point. It was just a decision, and you haven't taken any action to get any closer to that power. So though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it would have little permanent effect unless it once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And that becomes a great prayer. God, please help me face and be rid of the things in myself which are blocking me. From you, other people, and myself. This also tells me why I write inventory. It's not to feel better. It's to face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from God. That's why I write inventory. Ultimately, it is about accessing power. This is one of the tools in my kit of spiritual power tools. I like to call them spiritual power tools. It's like any other tools, if they're not plugged into something, they're not going to work very well. Right? Just to write inventory and think I'm going to write inventory so I can work on myself is not actually the purpose of this process, which is to get me closer to that which will help. And then it goes on to talk about things like not fooling yourself about the value of or resentments. Right? I can get resentful and I can have the idea that it's not that big of a deal. Right? And you get resentful again and you think, well, that's not that big of a deal, and resentful again. Before you know it, you've got a whole list again. Right? And a lot of times people come back to an inventory. Starting the inventory process, if you've gone through this more than once, it's not uncommon to start off with saying, well, this is going to be an easy one because I'm not resentful at anyone. And then you sit down to make your list and you see you've got a whole list. Right? Because you just kind of ignored it. It talks about not fooling myself about these resentments. I have a closet full of clothes. Right? And I'd say that I only wear a couple handfuls of it in the whole closet. Right? I've got shirts with the tag still on it. I really, really like the shirt. I just have never worn it, never pulled the tag off it even. And it just sits there taking up space in my closet. Right? And I can fool myself about the value of hanging on to it. But the more things that I get like that, the fuller my closet gets, and it's my closet's full. Right? If I was more realistic about what I'm hanging on to, you know, It's the same with my resentments. Right? I have to understand that hanging on to resentments are like poison for me. So, it says here resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And from it, from resentment, stem all sorts of spiritual disease. For we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. And it tells me here, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten up mentally and physically. I talked about that in the first column. I'm sorry, in the first step. Right? I have a spiritual malady that sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return. And when the obsessions return, I take that first drink. Okay. So, what it's telling me to do here is to make a list of the people that I'm resentful at. And when I'm working with someone, I just send them back to work on just that one thing. Just make a list of the people, institutions, and principles with whom you're resentful at. And I ask them not to worry too much about the second column, just make the list. Pray, ask God to show you what needs to be on there. Just write. And when they know that they're done with the list, then I ask them to go back and now take that list and write the cause of each resentment. And if there's more than one cause that they see, to letter them, A, B, C, D. Right? But now I tell them to start being realistic. Is it really a resentment? Because right? Sometimes, especially when somebody's new, in an effort to be thorough, they'll come up with this enormous list, which is good. It's what I want, because we're going to use the list later. But it isn't. But what you find a lot of times is a lot of names will make it on that first list that maybe there really isn't resentment in connection with it. And I don't tell them what has to stay there and what doesn't have to stay there. I just ask them to be realistic. Because a lot of people, especially when they're new and they're really excited about the process, you know, they're trying really hard to do really a really thorough job, right? But they don't know what's coming. They don't know that there's some work to do on this. Again, I just ask them to pray and just ask, is this really a resentment, or is it temporary anger? Because a temporary anger is different than resentment. Because a resentment is something that I re-feel when I think of it. People like when parents make the list or spouses, or sometimes there could be a lot of different resentments. I ask them to start to get realistic and look back at what they've written. If you've written five resentments on somebody, on one person, sit back and look at it and see if you're really saying one thing five times. Right? I've got some examples of an inventory I wrote. I actually have a lot more, if you wouldn't mind passing it down, or passing around. Oops. I actually have more examples on my website. Or I can email them to you if you want some more examples, if you're interested. So, what I tell people to do is to look over the cause of the resentment and see if they could bottom line it. You know, maybe to list all the different ways somebody was abusive to you can be just bottom lined by this person was abusive to me. Right? Again, I don't tell people what to write. I just try to get them to be realistic in the beginning so that they could start to develop some focus. Because one of the things I find when people are resentful at someone, my ego wants to validate my resentment to them, and I'll try to think of as many different ways and many different things that I could list why it's okay to be resentful at this person, because look at all the things that they've done to me. So there's a certain amount of focus that can be helpful if I'm asked to look over the list of the different resentments and just see if I can bottom line it. So at the top there where it says I'm resentful at, I put the name. And here I use the example of my ex-wife, Lori. And on this guide chart, this guide sheet for the resentment inventory, if you look at the bottom, it has a website address on it. And on there, if you email me, I can be glad to send you the thing that you could print these out with, and also the examples. Then you see that where it says the cause of the resentment. Lori, my wife, is who I was resentful at, my first wife. The cause of the resentment was left me when I was just getting sober and needed her most. I actually had thrown her out initially, but she was having some problems and needed to move into a different place. And I offered her that she could move back in and build up some money so that she could make a move into another place. Because she didn't have enough money to initially move from one apartment to another. And so she moved back in when I just had like a month or two sober. But what had happened, okay, here's an example of who Dan was at 6 months sober. At 6 months sober, her parents told her, if you don't leave him, we're never going to talk to you again. We're going to disown you. Right? So she left. She left me in the middle of, at 6 months sobriety. Right? And I thought I was doing great. And then below that, where it says affects mine, and then it's listed, I've listed self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. And if you look at this chart here on page 65, where it says we are usually as definite as this example, there's people that will look at this example and say, this is the fourth step right here. Right? The name, what they did, and what it affects. And some people have seen those little check boxes, what it affects, and there'll be a list of different things that it'll affect. And I've done those. In fact, I had five sponsors in my first year, and so I had exposure to different inventories. The first inventory that one sponsor gave me was an autobiographical inventory. Just write down what I think the fourth step was about and who I was mad at. So all I really did is write down a bunch of information that I already knew, right? Nothing new, just what I had already known. I wrote it down on paper. The next inventory was out of a hospital's pamphlet, a famous hospital's pamphlet, a four-step pamphlet. And I answered the questions that I thought applied, and I ignored the rest. Again, any inventory I do that's not out of this big book can't lead me down the same path that the big book's going to lead me. The next one was this other thing, and I also did one of those checkbox inventories that you see around where you just check what's affected. None of them really gave me any new information. I certainly felt good that I finished something because I was trusting who gave it to me and I finished it, but there was no new information, no shift, no experience, Right? But looking at the way this the guide sheet is listed, you'll see it looks a lot like this chart where it says we're usually as definite as this example. I'm resentful at, which is Mr. Brown, the cause, right? She left me when I needed her most, and affects my, and there's seven areas of self listed on the page, right? Self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. And then it has fear bracketed alongside it. But below that it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty, and when we were finished, we considered it carefully. So there's two ways to consider this carefully. Naturally, one way to consider it carefully is just to think about it and contemplate it in my mind. But if I'm going to read it to somebody else, it's going to be better to write it out. So to consider it carefully is what you see written next to each one of these things. Self-esteem, how does that affect it? Right, I write it out. Pride, I write it out. Now the other thing that I want to mention is if you turn to page 67 where it talks about fear, look what it says. It says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties. So it's implying that I've already done the fear here, right? Because it says it's already bracketed alongside the difficulties. And my difficulties are not self-esteem, and my difficulties aren't pride, ambition, security. They aren't those seven things, right? Those are good things. Those are the things I need to get back. My difficulty is, what do I do with those things, right? So my difficulties is what I've written here, and I bracket the fear that drive those difficulties. And I allow the third column to show me what the fear is. I don't just go into my head and make up fears. I don't make a list of fears like spiders and snakes or, right? I'm making a list of the fears that drive the thinking. Right? Remember on 62 where it says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Right? And I see my selfish, self-centered false notions in what I write here in the third column and how it's driven by 100 forms of fear and then the stuff on the fourth column, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. So what I've got here is under Lori, left me when I needed her most. Next to self-esteem is how I see or feel about myself. It's the role I've assigned myself in this little relationship. Keep something else in mind. That in how it works, the third step and the fourth step are in the same chapter. There's a theme here that Bill uses. He's talking about the actor trying to run the whole show, right? And there's going to be some references later on in the chapter about like being in the world to play the role that God assigns. So, sticking with that theme, my self-esteem and who I think I am, it's the role I've assigned myself in this relationship. And I start this to keep some focus on this with I am. And what I've wrote here is I am the best husband she could get. Now that might seem a little arrogant, but keep in mind that if I thought I was the worst husband she could get, I'd be resentful at me, not her. All right? And I look at that statement that I wrote, I am the best husband she could get, to tell me what the fear is that I'm not the best husband she could have, that I'm not good enough. And I write that to the right of it. So each fear has something to do with what I've written while I'm looking at my selfish, self-centered ideas. Right, I'm starting to attach the fears that are underneath that. Now the next one is pride. Now self-esteem and pride are like two sides of a coin. Self-esteem is what I think I am. Pride is what I think you should think I am. It's the role I've assigned you. Right? It's how I think others should see or feel about me. What I wrote here is no one should think that I'm not worth staying with. Right? And the fear that I wrote next to that was the fear of being worthless. Right? You see how I'm tying the fear into the statement in the third column? Now there's ambition and security. Those are like two sides of a coin. Ambition is what I want out here. Security is what I need inside to be okay. So my ambition was, I want to be loved. The fear is that I'm not loved. And other ambition here is that I wanted to be wanted by her. The fear is that I'm not wanted by her. That's what I wanted out here. I wanted to be loved and I wanted to be wanted. But what I wanted inside was that I wanted to know that I wouldn't be abandoned, no matter what I did. Right? So the fear that I've got written down here is abandoned, the fear of being abandoned. Now, personal relations and sex relations, those are like two sides of a coin too. Personal relations are the deep-seated ideas of the way I think the relationship is supposed to look. Sex relations are my deep-seated idea of the way a man is in a relationship. So what I wrote here for personal relations is, wives never leave their husbands. That's my deep-seated idea of the way a husband and a wife are supposed to be. Wives never leave. The fear there is being alone. The sex relations, what I wrote for that is, a real man commands the respect of their wife. Not respected is the fear. And under pocketbook, I only write on the pocketbook if it's got something to do with money. No one should disregard the value of my financial support. Not valued. Now, it's interesting the way that it's laid out. Because if you read this backwards, this is who I think I am this is who I think a real man is supposed to be. And when I put that real man in the relationship, a man and wife relationship, this is the way I think this relationship is supposed to look with this real man in it. And based on what I think this relationship is supposed to look like, there's certain things that I need to happen inside to be okay. And based on what I think I need inside to be okay, right, I want certain things to happen around me to satisfy that. And in order to try to get what I want to happen outside here around me, I've assigned her a role in my play and me a role in this play. So it actually works upside down. And as long as there's fear that can attach to each one of these, I see that these things give power to the thinking in the third column. Because if I wasn't afraid of these things, then when column one did column two, I'd have neutrality. But I've never been able to do that on my own. In the bottom of 66... It talks about turning back to the list, for it held the key to the future. It says we're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Right? We began to see the world and its people really dominated us, and in that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So here what it's saying is the key to my future is to be at a place where I can master my resentments. Right? Right? And just before this it said resentments had the power to kill me. And if you think about it, what could knock you off your spiritual condition more than a good resentment? Right? And then it's going to tell me what I need to do. It says, this was our course. just we realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we didn't like their symptoms the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. So how would I look at how they're spiritually sick like I am? Keeping in mind that I'm not inventorying them, I'm inventorying me. Right? It's not about blaming them as being spiritually sick, and that's why I have to be mad at them. Right? It's about seeing how I'm spiritually sick like they are. So the only thing that I have to work with is Lori left me when I needed her most. So I ask myself on each resentment, how have I done the things in column 2 to the person in column 1 and or others? So in pondering that, what I have written down here is, I left her alone a lot while I was drinking. And so I see that I left her way before she left me, because alcohol became more important than my relationship with my wife. She spent many nights alone, not knowing where I was, not knowing if I was going to come home, right? To the extent that it put her in a place where completely... I used to say, she was so nice when I met her. I don't know what happened. Right? I didn't realize that my behavior was driving her crazy. And it was putting her in a place where she just didn't know what was going on. And I see that I had left her long before she left me. So then it's asking me to look back at the list, setting aside the wrongs that others have done me, and resolutely looking at my own mistakes. And it asked me to look at where I've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And if you notice, that's the same thing that it talks about on 62, where it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, that's dishonesty with myself, self-seeking, and self-pity, that's selfishness. Right? So those same things are noted on page 62. And it says these things are what drives the thinking. It gives power to the thinking in the third column. Right? So I go through each resentment and I look at, put aside what the other people have done, and I just look at my own behavior. Right? And the way I differentiate between self-seeking and selfishness, self-seeking is my selfish actions, and selfishness is my selfish attitude. So first I just look at my actions, at my self-seeking actions. I left her alone a lot, stayed out late drinking, sometimes didn't come home, only concerned with what I needed. I was married, acting single. So then I asked myself, well, what was I thinking while I was doing those things? My selfish attitudes. It's my life. I'm not hurting anyone. She has no right to tell me how to live. Right? That was my attitude behind these actions. And then what I do is, for dishonesty, I look at the delusions in my thinking above. Right? And I look at my selfish attitude and I ask myself, what are the lies I'm telling myself? So what I wrote here is, I'm in the delusion that marriages can't last and that they always fail. Right? And then what I do is I look at the fear that is under that delusion. So all of these just kind of pull me down into this place. I look at the fear underneath my delusion, And that is, I'm never going to be good enough to keep a relationship going, and I'll end up alone. So again, I can read this backwards. I have a deep-seated fear that I'm not really good enough to keep a relationship going, and I'll end up alone. And because I've got fear, I have a delusion that marriages can't last and it'll always fail. And based on the delusion that a marriage can't last and it'll always fail, I adopted the attitude that it's my life. I'm not hurting anyone because it's about, you know, because it's only my life. And she has no right to tell me how to live because she's going to leave anyway. And based in having that attitude, I can't do anything but have the self-seeking actions, leave her at home alone, stayed out late drinking, right? So all this stuff actually is working backwards in my life. Pardon me? Self-fulfilling prophecy? The problem is that I have to see that I can't do anything different about this on my own. I have this fear that drives these delusions that result in an attitude that end up in certain actions. And I see that over and over again that this stuff has harmed the people that I care about the most. And at the bottom of each one of these pages, I consider, how have I harmed the person that I'm writing about and anybody around the situation? Again, I know that this can be really dry just to listen to. And when I work with people, I have to feed it to them a little bit at a time, right? You know, there's a lot of different ways people can write inventory. Right? And there's some methods are probably easier than others, right? But this particular way it showed me things about myself that I really needed to see. Because again, this is a spiritual awakening that's going to take me to God, and the things that are going to drive me to God are not. It's not going to be an inventory that makes me feel good. This is not what this is about. It's not about writing inventory to feel good. Because comfort's temporary. Right? This is about getting free. This is about seeing the things that motivate my behavior and my attitudes. Right? And to see the things about myself that I find objectionable and that I need to turn to God for help with. So it says in the bottom of 67 where it says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, employer, my wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. I can see that the whole fabric of this resentment is shot through with fear. When I've attached a fear to each one of those seven areas of self, that it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Again, as I said before, if I didn't have the fear, then I wouldn't be so reactive to the thinking, right? It gave power to the thinking in the third column. But did we not ourselves set the ball in motion? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Fear ought to be classed with stealing. Because fear robs me of the life I might have had if I didn't have the fear. Right? Does that make sense? Fear robs me of the life I might have had if I wasn't living based in fear. Talks about reviewing the fears thoroughly and asking ourselves why we had them. Some of you have done the fears where you list the fear and ask yourself why you had that fear and put a fear next to it. But I don't have an example of it here to show you, but you, if you continue to ask yourself next to, if you list all your fears in one column from every inventory, and then next to those fears write the fear that's underneath that fear, and just cross out the duplicates, right? The list will get smaller and smaller as you make a third column of the fears, asking yourself why you had those fears, and continue to ask yourself why you had those fears. And what a lot of people come down to is the last fears, as the list gets smaller, and what's underneath most fears is I fear being alone. I fear the emotional pain that's underneath the being alone. If I sit in emotional pain long enough, I would fear drinking. For me to drink is to die. Right? And then, that's usually where people stop about there, but then what I usually talk about to them is, well, why do you fear dying? Because obviously if you thought things were going to be great, then there would be no fear of dying. The fact is, I don't know that if things are going to be better or worse if I die. So I really don't, I'm fearing something that I don't know about. Right? The unknown. So why would I fear the unknown? And obviously it's because I fear that there's really nothing on the other side, no God on the other side that's going to catch me. No God underneath any of this that's going to help me. Right? So why would I fear there being no God? Because self-reliance continues to fail me. And if that's all there is, then there's no more for me. And this whole thing could shift. What it talks about here, it talks about, I think there's a better way. For now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. If I trusted that there was a God, then maybe I wouldn't fear the unknown, because I would believe that there was a God on the other side. If I didn't fear the unknown, then I wouldn't fear dying. If I didn't fear dying or drinking, then if I knew that there was a God, then that would save me. Then wouldn't fear dying. I wouldn't fear drinking again because I believe that there's a God that'll save me from that, and I wouldn't never feel alone, so I wouldn't really worry about the emotional pain, because if I really trusted and relied that there's a God, right, then, you know, because there's times that I felt alone in a room full of people, right, and there's times when I've been alone and didn't even think twice about it. So that feeling of being alone has nothing to do really with what's going on outside of me, but it's got more to do with what's going on inside of me. And if I trust and rely that there is a God, then I probably won't feel alone. So I won't suffer that emotional pain, right? Because I'll never feel alone. When I have it all laid out with fears to walk you through, it's much easier to grasp this, but you can walk all the way back through all the fears and say, with a simple reliance on God, I wouldn't have had this fear. And if I wouldn't have had these fears, then when column one does column two, and I had this thinking with no fears to power it, I'd have neutrality. And ultimately, that's what our goal is a place of neutrality. Right? But I have to see that I can't get that on my own. Right? I have a whole list of resentments that I write out like this. What I've recently found too is that sometimes this can be a little overwhelming for some people. And what I'll do is on the fourth column, I'll just give them two things at a time. I talk to them about self-esteem and pride. I say, go home and do the self-esteem and pride on all of them. And then talk about the ambition and security. Just send them to go do the ambition and security. Just do all of them. It actually turns out to be more work in the long run, but what I found is people will do it faster because it's less overwhelming, and have a better understanding of each part. Now, there might be a kind of a mechanical sound to that, worrying about someone understanding this, right? But really, the better I can understand the inventory process, the easier it's going to be for me to 10-step later. Right? Same thing with the other side. I'll give them I'll have them do the realization first. Now, there's not much work. I've had people go and do 80 resentments in less than 2 hours. But the thing about working with people up to the fourth step, I'll meet every week. And then in the past, it was okay. I'd give them instructions for the fourth step, give them the first instruction, say, okay, call me when you're done, right? And all of a sudden, their accountability has ended. They don't have a deadline. And what I found is that a lot of people that I work with have worked really well with deadlines, right? So I say, just have these two things done by next week. And if they've waited even to the last day before we were supposed to get together, it's just a little bit that they have to catch up on, and they get it done. And even with that, it's proven to work out faster in the long run, and you don't have people sitting in inventory for a year, right? Providing they're consistent, right? And stay accountable. What I usually do is I have them, we still meet each week, right? Certainly there's people that don't stay accountable, but what are you going to do? You know, I've got mine, right? So there's certain things that I need to see here, and certain things that an inventory like this will lay out, right? One of the things that I have to see is that one of the things that it talks about in the fifth step, in the first paragraph, it talks about seeing the defects of character. Right? And it also says, a couple lines below that, is also seeing the nature of my defects. Right? And it never says that we make a list of character defects in the book. It says that we did it. It implies we did it when we took inventory. And I look at my character defects as the defects in my behavior. Right? And I see the defects in my behavior, in my selfish attitudes and my selfish actions. Right? So that my defective behavior is that I left her alone a lot, stayed out drinking, didn't come home, only concerned with what I needed, and was married acting single. And my defective attitude was, it's my life, I'm not hurting anyone. She has no right to tell me how to live. There's a list of my character defects. I don't have to make them up. Right? But look at what it also says on that first paragraph of the fifth step. It talks about the nature of my defects. Now, how I differentiate between the defects of character, which is out here, you see my attitude and my actions, right? But the nature of my defects are in here. It's like my alcoholic behavior is I drink too much, I get into trouble, I lose jobs, fight with people, and all that stuff that everybody sees out here. But the nature of my alcoholism is I lose control when I start, and I have a spiritual malady that takes me to an obsession that results in that first drink. That's the nature of my alcoholism. So here, the nature of my defect, where I'll see that is in my dishonesty and my fear. That's the nature of my defect. I have these deep-seated fears that result in delusions. Right? And so this inventory will show you what the nature of those defects are. Now, another thing that you'll see is with when people are reading Fifth Step and they look at defects of character, they'll make a list of things that they think that they're going to work on. But the things that you think you're going to work on is usually my actions and my attitudes, right? The things that I do and my attitudes, right? And the truth is a lot of things you can work, these things you can work on, right? Until you start to look at the nature of the defects. Because I cannot work on the fears, and I cannot work on the delusions. Right? And that's what I have to see here, that there's things in this resentment that are so deeply ingrained that I could not behave any differently. Absolutely could not have behaved any differently by myself on my own. And we're going to get back to that later. Unless it's a current resentment. You know, just because I write inventory doesn't mean I'm never going to have a resentment again. Right? But ultimately, I know where it's going. Right? And that's really what the 10th step is about. I have an idea where it's going and what the value of a 10th step is. Continue to take personal inventory. Because this is not just about writing a 4th step and I'm done. This is about learning a way of life. Right? A way of life conducive to staying neutral. To staying out of deep resentment. Right? And the only way that I can really get good at it is to not do it well. And to see how badly I still need to do it. Right? If that makes any sense. Like, I don't evolve into this person that is always completely untouchable. Right? But I have some tools today. Right? So, I guess we should touch on sex a little bit. And we see that on page 69. Now, I don't know that Bill did that on purpose or not. But it's funny to notice that on page 69 is where the sex inventory is. But look what it says on page 96. There's actually instructions on how to get involved in relationships. On page 96 it says, "Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer." That's a joke. So here it tells me that it's not about them telling me what kind of sex I'm supposed to have, but it's encouraging me to look at my sex conduct. The sex inventory is not about how I like it or what I want from you. It's about behavior, how I treat you. And if you look in the guidebook, the Big Book Awakening book, it lays out some questions. On the first page, there's three questions. They aren't in the Big Book, but they're helpful when you're reading inventory to someone if you want them to kind of understand where you're going with the relationship. It's, how did it start? Major points that came up in the relationship. And how did it end, or how is it now? So we write a little quick, really brief inventory just so that the person listening kind of knows what the thing is about. And then the book talks about 9 questions to consider. It says, we reviewed our conduct over the past over the years past. Where had I been selfish? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where would I at fault? And one of the, what I consider is the most important question, is what should I have done instead? Now, most people get this question wrong. And I say that jokingly because it's the easiest thing or place for my mind to go with what should I have done instead was not to get involved in the first place. Which may have been true, but in a personal inventory where I'm examining my behavior and I want to know what should I have done instead in the relationship. Because that's what's going to help me move beyond where I am. Because in the next paragraph, it refers to whatever my ideal turns out to be. I must be willing to grow towards it. I write a sex ideal. And it's based on what comes out of question 9. What should I have done instead? Because what I see that I should have done instead, obviously, was not behavior I was capable of doing. You know, I had a lot of relationships, and there was only one thing consistent in all of them. That was I was in it. Right? And to examine the ideas of what should I have done instead and put that into a prayer, God, please, in the future, help me be dot, 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 and fill in the blanks. Because what I'll see is in the past I have been unable to be any different in those relationships. Right? And ultimately this is about turning to God for help with all of this stuff. And what you'll find is at the end of the of each, as I said before, at the end of these each of these sections, they're going to kind of summarize what they wanted us to know, or what they wanted to get out of this. It says, if we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies. For we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. So, after someone I'm working with gets all this stuff together, right? Sometimes it's been a few months, and one of the things that I'll do is I'll send them back to consider if there are any other resentments that have come up since we started, or anything else that has to be on the list, anything else that they haven't written about, that they feel needs to be on here, so that when we actually fifth step, it's complete. What I also ask them to do is to make a note of any secrets that they haven't been willing to tell anybody, that they've kept to themselves. Because there's a reference to that in the fifth step about hanging on to things that that we're not willing to share with anyone. And I have to ask them to pray and consider if they feel that this inventory is complete. And when they say that they're sure that it's all as complete as they could possibly make it, then we set a date as soon as we can and get to it. And I'm going to talk more about that afterwards. But being asked to listen to an inventory is certainly an honor. It hopefully it's based on somebody trusting you with their stuff. My own experience was I didn't necessarily trust my sponsor completely. And I asked him if there was somebody else I could read it to. Because I just didn't think he was sensitive enough to my special needs. And his response was, if you don't trust me, then you need to find someone else to read it to and to work with. And I thought, well, shit, that's not where exactly I was going with all this. You know, I just had some stuff about him I didn't want to have to read to him. And so what I did is I just held those back and read them to somebody else, and I read him all the rest of the stuff. Because one of the things that I was told is that the fifth step is not an opportunity to tell your sponsor what you think of them, what you really think, if you have issues with them. Now, I had deep respect for Joe, my sponsor. He changed my life, gave me an immense amount of of growth, of stuff that I wouldn't have gotten anywhere else. You know, but he had people from all over the world bothering him. I just happened to live a couple blocks from where he lived, so he was convenient for me. But he had people from all over the world, so he was kind of short. As far as he didn't have a lot of time for everybody, because his time was spread thin, and that was part of my thing with him. But trust, I certainly trusted him as somebody who knew what this thing was about. Certainly did. And when it came time, he put everything else aside and just sat with me, and we read through it until it was done. It took more than a day. It took a couple meetings, but we got it done. When it was done, we were all finished with it, he says, okay, now take all this stuff and go sit with it and consider the sixth step. But what I want to do with that now is wait. Well, I'll pick up on that where we left off on the next time we get together. Does anybody know what time that is? Okay. Dinner's at 6, so I think it's at 7. Yeah, I think it's at 7 o'clock. Okay. All right. So when we're done, I'll finish 5, 6, and 7 on the next section. Okay? Thanks. Oh, and again, I have more examples of these that I can email you, and blank pages if you wanted to try filling out the inventory this way. Thanks.